I think we can all agree that brevity is the soul of wit, and hence Tom is among the wittiest of all of us. So I have to catch a plane back to the East Coast, so forgive me for just jumping straight in. And I want to follow on and just give a shout out Tom's book, his comments. I really appreciated what he has contributed, and I don't think there was a single item that he spoke about that I disagreed with. If anything, I would emphasize even more strongly, and it is a little disillusioning to have my industry and my profession just ground into the dirt in the way that it had. We're not all evil, and there actually are good people that work in the government. I can assure you this from personal experience, but we certainly are guilty, those of us that provide government, quote, service, of all of the sins and more that Tom Woods summarized just a few moments ago. Following on his comments, I'd like to emphasize four observations. Modern public health relies on the use of psychological bioterrorism or fear porn. Pharma uses media to promote psychological bioterrorism for profit. This is the exploitation of fear of death. This is what you've been subjected to. This is the whip that was used to drive you with these behaviors, is the weaponized fear of death. It was repeated again and again and again, and it was based on false pretenses, grounded in statistical projections that have had absolutely no merit or validity, but were extremely useful for those who wished to advance whatever the agenda is. And I think we're still all wrestling with what was the underlying agenda behind this, just like we're all wrestling with the big issue that others have frequently emphasized. Who were the puppet masters behind all this? Because clearly, this was coordinated globally. Now, we have discovered, thank you, Doge, and others, at least some aspect of the puppet masters, and they have a name. The name is USAID. And as Tom Benz likes to say, I was convinced that it was the CIA that was coordinating all this global messaging and propaganda and fear porn and all that that's been going on, because all of the messaging has been harmonized. One of the advantages of traveling, as I have done over the last 4 years, Jill and I like to say that our big achievement last year was that we didn't make the premier 1K club on United Airlines. But I had come to the conclusion that the only organization globally that had the power and reach in order to implement this kind of coordinated messaging and purchasing of influencers all across the Western world was the CIA. And I've spoken to people that have, let's say, significant ties to the intelligence community, and they all concur with the thesis that the CIA now has become arguably the most powerful organization, certainly in the West, that has existed in modern history. But as Mike Benz likes to say, when something is too dirty for the CIA, they gave it to USAID. And that's kind of what happened here with all of the management of press and information, propaganda, psychological warfare technology. As I spoke about the last time I was here with the Mises Institute, and I'm very grateful for that and grateful for Tom and Karen and others inviting me back and for the various sponsors that have enabled me to come back and speak to you today. Psychological bioterrorism and psychological warfare technology has been integrated into modern pharmaceutical industry marketing. And this approach is now migrating into other industries such as chicken egg production. We now have a investigation ongoing about some players in the chicken egg industry in the United States having actively exploited the fear of death and disruption from avian influenza as a way to drive up egg prices. This, you know, Mises talks and the founders, the intellectual drivers behind Mises often talk about the role of government in enabling monopolies. And certainly we are seeing examples of that in this interface between industry, big government, big business, and psychological warfare and infectious disease, public health. Another point. It's not physicians that are running public health. Now, maybe that I have a vested interest in making that statement, but it's true. It's the Master's in Public Health awardees. An MPH is a two-year degree, which does not require you have any prior training in health, in biology, in medicine. It's primarily focused on the use of big data and statistical analysis in order to optimize often single variables, which is consistent with Tom's thesis that we have this narrow, I would use the term siloed. I missed that in his lecture, but that's a common term in DC speak, is that all of these sectors, let's call them, within the federal bureaucracy are extremely siloed. And as he correctly points out, they tend to drive towards optimization of those parameters that they believe are within their domain to the exclusion of impacts on other domains and other parameters. Matter of fact, this is one of the challenges in bureaucracy is they're often fighting over the boundaries between their silo and adjacent silos and who has the rights to control those boundaries and how those resources should be allocated across those silos. The MPH doesn't require any training. It focuses on big data analysis and optimization of single variables. The practice of medicine has a centuries-long history of rejecting and ridiculing innovators and dissenters. We should, as Tom points out, we should have absolutely no surprise about what we've seen. It's no surprise that all of this follows a narrative that we have seen played out over the centuries, where physicians who are taught to assimilate a set of truths, unquestionably, and implement and regurgitate those truths, are extremely resistant to change. They view change as heresy. In many ways, what we have in modern public health and the practice of medicine more closely resembles a religion than it resembles anything that we might call science. And in our books, we refer to this as scientism. This is a term that's become widely used. And we assert that scientism has been substituted for religion in modern political action and thought. Okay, so this religion of belief in a set of endorsed scientific truths or pseudoscientific truths is scientism, and it has high priesthood. That high priesthood is aligned with what Tom was speaking about quite eloquently from his different frame of reference. Now, with those kind of lead-ins that are a segue from Tom Wood's really eloquent position and talk that he gave us just now, I'd like to talk and specifically focus transition from the Cywar frame of reference in the prior Mises talk to this new issue and this new dialectic that exists between Make America Healthy Again as a movement and Make America Great Again as a movement. They're actually two separate things, and they have different constituencies and different drivers. And in many ways, they resolve into pro-regulatory big government initiatives versus promotion of deregulation and small government. In theory, Make America Great Again is more aligned with libertarian principles. Make America Healthy Again, in my opinion, is much more aligned with big government and regulation. And within that, we can discern some real tensions that are playing out in real time as we're watching and will continue to play out over the next 4 years. And I can't predict what the outcome is going to be. It's worth noting that the MAHA movement, Make America Healthy Again, exists outside of Kennedy and the government and encompasses many societal issues outside of the focus of the Trump administration. For example, homesteading, medical and personal sovereignty, personal responsibility for healthcare choices, these may all be outside of the MAHA whole-of-government approach. Remember, this is a presidential directive now, the MAHA Commission. It has specific objectives, goals, requirements, deliverables that's separate from MAHA as a movement. For this discussion, I'm primarily concerned with the MAHA directives within the government, but MAHA is much bigger than that. I just want to make that key point. It's bigger than Kennedy. It's been going on for years, and in many ways, it was Kelly and Casey Means through a series of interviews, including, I think, 4 hits on Tucker and 1 on Rogan, that really brought this to fore. And their logic that, for example, big food, big ag, has been contaminated with the money from Philip Morris that was required to move out of big tobacco and moved into big food. And in Kelly and Casey Means' thesis, then applied the marketing strategies and approach that had characterized big tobacco of making for a addicted consumer base as a great business model, and has applied that to big food. And when you see a lot of the activities that are associated with big food and big ag, it's hard to escape the underlying truth of that metaphor. Now, MAHA, as we know it now, has emerged mainly from the left. There are those that disagree with this, particularly those within the MAHA movement, out of frustration to the Democratic Party corruption and rejection, has embraced the center right. So this remember how this all played out. Bobby wasn't originally talking about making America healthy again. He assimilated that agenda as it began to build momentum during the election and made it his own. But in so doing, he was coming from the left. Remember, Kennedy's thesis was that there existed a population of what he called Kennedy Democrats that we could really call New Deal Democrats. They are the Democrat Party of the 60s, pre-Reagan, pre-Carter, pre-Clintons. Those are the people that Bobby thought would come back to him within the Democrat Party. That thesis failed for a variety of different reasons. So MAHA has emerged mainly from the left out of frustration and has enthusiastically endorsed MAGA center-right populists, including many formerly associated with the Tea Party movement, in part because it was rejected by the left. Bobby's inability to gain any traction within the Democrat primaries, where he was locked out, kind of forced him into this position, this series of decisions. And at one point, some of you may be aware, there was active outreach from the former Libertarian Party to Bobby, who had positions, who could have enabled Bobby to be on the ballot in all 50 states without having to have this enormous campaign funded by Nicole Shanahan. But Bobby didn't want to do that. He didn't want to position himself as a Libertarian. In the end, he ran as an independent. That failed. And we'll talk about how that developed. The arc of the presidential campaign of RFK Jr. closely adheres to this narrative. Bobby started out seeking the Democrat Party nomination, representing Kennedy Democrats. But the Democrat Party of today bears little resemblance to that of his father and uncle's time. And the changes in national political thought on both left and right wrought by Carter, Reagan, and then the succession of the military-industrial corporatists, Bushies, and the Clinton-Obama-Biden on the left. To no one's surprise, apparently, other than Bobby and his team, today's Democrat Party makes it abundantly clear that there's no room for Kennedy in this tent, this Kennedy. So he decided to make a run as an independent, as I was saying. Nicole Shanahan stepped up to bankroll it. And amazingly, they managed to get on the ballot in all 50 states. But it became clear that once again, an independent run would primarily function as a spoiler. And I know this because I was very close to the campaign at this point in time and very aware of all the discussions that were going on. What should Bobby do? What are his options? The pivotal moment was when RFK Jr. placed an empathetic phone call to Donald Trump after the assassination attempt, which still reeks of a deep state operation, much like what happened to Bobby's uncle and father. And Bobby did so in a spectacular manner with a ringing endorsement, a speech that will live on through the ages. I think many of you have heard and seen this. Go back in time. So MAHA originates from the left, but the appeal crosses all party lines. Who does not want to be more healthy? The initial MAHA mandate from President Trump is to demonstrate measurable improvements in the health of U.S. citizens within 12 to 18 months, with a particular focus on chronic disease and children's health. One aspect of this effort will involve refocusing the Health and Human Services, the largest branch of the U.S. government, by the way, exceeds the size of the DOD by budget, at least the visible budget, on health promotion and de-emphasizing disease-specific treatment. At its core, MAHA is predominantly pro-regulation. Let that sink in. The logic is that we must use regulatory authority to improve transparency and eliminate that which leads to unhealthy outcomes. Examples include drugs with side effects that, when considered in whole, do not have a strongly favorable risk-benefit ratio. An example being glyphosate or Roundup, contamination of our grain and soybeans is just one overt example. Of course, recently we have the removal of food dyes. However, there's also a deregulatory aspect to the MAHA movement. For example, is unpasteurized milk really a health risk? What health promotion properties are associated with unpasteurized milk? Similarly, the move towards backyard poultry and eating locally slaughtered grass-fed beef, or re-examination of the widespread U.S. policy of fluoridating municipal water supplies. These are all big government mandates that are being pushed against. And there's also an investigational research aspect. For example, what are the drivers behind the explosion of autism, obesity, and other childhood chronic diseases? This is an explicit mandate coming from Donald Trump through the MAHA Commission. To date, the MAHA movement has primarily focused on things that big government can do to promote improved health of U.S. citizens. That's the truth. Removing known toxins from food, hence the recent announcement. Investigating autism causes. Questioning the pediatric vaccine schedule and revising the CDC VAERS vaccine adverse event reporting system so that truly informed decisions can be made concerning the safety and efficacy of vaccine products. This is where MAHA is going currently. Behind all that, and we can say, as you know, who isn't for improved children's health? Who isn't for improved food purity? There are 10,000 oil-based, petroleum-based compounds that are authorized by the FDA for inclusion in our food supply right now. And there has been absolutely no investigation long-term of any of these, because the way, you know, consistent with a lot of what Tom was saying, the way the system works is once the bureaucracy makes a decision, they rarely, if ever, go back and revisit that decision. And that is rampant through the entire HHS structure. It is what underlies the reason why these food dyes took so long to be withdrawn. The data have been there for decades. The information about the role of these dyes in ADHD in children has been known for a very long period of time. It is exceedingly well documented. And yet the FDA did nothing. Because their policy, consistent with Tom's thesis, is that once a decision is made, they never go back and look at it. They tend to never, CDC and FDA, to never set up any processes where they revisit past decisions. And this also, by the way, can be seen in the vaccine enterprise. Short-term data is acquired, in the case of many of the pediatric vaccines, during the 60s, using rules and regulations and policies and clinical trial research norms that are long since obsolete. But those limited data from back then allowed the FDA at that point in time to make a go decision on authorizing those and authorizing those for the pediatric vaccine schedule, and they never go back and revisit that with new data. It's just not in the structure. The whole structure of the approval process is driven by approving the thing in front of them right now, not going back and looking at whether or not there's interactions between any of these drugs or compounds or vaccines, or whether or not that decision was a good decision, or whether or not they missed some long-term safety signal because they were only looking at short-term data. It's not done. Because, as Tom points out, that is kind of fundamental to the nature of bureaucracy. Once they make a decision, they don't ever want to revisit it. It becomes locked in stone, and they move forward from that. A derivative of this is that behind the potential of the MAHA initiative to improve our lives and importantly, improve childhood chronic disease. If this gets institutionalized and bureaucratized, it will morph into another overbearing set of nanny-state mandates. There is no way to avoid that. And basically, my talk here is a plea to you folks who are kind of at the tip of the spear concerning bureaucracy and the administrative state. I plea that we need you, we need your intellectual input to help set the boundaries and parameters around the MAHA initiative. It's not being done right now. Nobody's talking about what the proper boundary should be. Nobody's talking about the interface between the rights of the benefits of having a state-sponsored regulatory apparatus for ensuring food safety and product health. We seem to have a consensus that this is necessary. That actually is debatable. But that is the current consensus. But no one is talking about what happens once the administrative state gets its teeth into this initiative. Because if you think about it, I often use the example of, let's say there's a person who loves McDonald's hamburgers consumed with sugary Coca-Cola. You know who I'm talking about. Should the state mandate that such a person should not eat these things despite the clear-cut health risks? Should the state outlaw cigars? What about regulating foods? Where should MAHA draw the line? What principles should be applied to guide these decisions? What is the proper role of small government as it relates to food and drug regulation? This is unexplored territory as far as I'm concerned. And it needs intellectual input. It needs guidance. It needs informed discussion. Where are the boundaries? And if we don't set those boundaries, I guarantee that the administrative state will continue to just expand and run rampant as it assimilates the MAHA initiative and begins to institutionalize it and exploit it. This really involves the boundaries between individual sovereignty, libertarianism, Murray Rothbard's anarcho-capitalism, and the utilitarian socialist logic of modern public health. Another area that Tom and I agree on strongly. The modern public health enterprise seeks the greatest good for the greatest number and is driven by narrow analysis of large data sets to identify, regulate, promote, and mandate specific healthcare interventions, such as vaccines, while often disregarding other related issues, including long-term unanticipated or difficult to predict consequences, exactly what was emphasized in the prior lecture. A, quote, public health enterprise that seeks to achieve optimization of collective health outcomes rather than optimizing health opportunities, coupled to respect for individual autonomy or choice, which is what I advocate, a public health enterprise that has repeatedly used top-down management via government, insurer, and health management organizations to require and deploy pre-approved treatment protocols rather than individually optimized healthcare management and promotion, reflecting each patient's complexities. In other words, what I'm saying is the practice of modern medicine, particularly under Obamacare, has come down to protocol-driven application of modules. If you are tested and answer questions that can be now interpreted by AI quite efficiently, you will be binned into one of these categories, and then you will be subjected to a pre-approved protocol. Modern physicians, I'm not defending my caste, it's just the fact, don't have a lot of operational latitude under the current structure. They have to implement the policies, procedures, and protocols that they're given. Otherwise, they lose their job. And when you're sitting with the chains of, you know, quarter to half to three quarters of $1 million in debt at high interest rates, so you basically have a couple of mortgages, you don't have any choice. Consider seatbelt mandates. Like many big government initiatives that stand on the top of slippery slopes, there's a general consensus that it's right and proper for government to mandate seatbelts be installed on cars. But is it right to legally require their use when driving? Next comes motorcycle helmets. Same issues, slightly less clear. Cigarette smoking. In all three cases, the argument is made that irresponsible health behaviors by individuals cost all of society due to increased health care and insurance costs, including publicly subsidized costs and loss of person years. The same logic can then be applied all the way down to whether or not the state should mandate your dietary choices, which is why I use the McDonald's hamburger example. Should we allow citizens to experiment with nutraceuticals and health supplements that are not officially endorsed by the FDA? What rights do they have to do that? They may be costing the public health enterprise money. They may be costing tax dollars that would be avoidable. This is the logic that we confront. This is where MAHA we risk going with the MAHA initiative. And there we go, right straight to nanny state medical fascism. But seatbelts save lives. Air traffic controllers save lives most of the time. You get my point. The greatest good for the greatest number has become a logical fallacy. For a while, it seemed to work, but when you look at 21st century incarnation in particular, it has become badly corrupted. The history and reality behind vaccines is perhaps the best example in modern times, but the entire topic of public health, quote unquote, needs to be deconstructed as it's practiced today. Public health is good when the objectives are clear, make sense to everyone, and are transparent in implementation and the results measurable. We have wonderful examples: clean water, sanitation, modern sewers, sewage treatment, waste management, which, by the way, is really responsible for the biggest impact on the decline in infectious disease. It's not vaccines. Credit where credit's due. Clean air in places with local air pollution, antibiotics, advanced surgical procedures. We can go on and on and on. This is the history of public health in the 20th century, but things seem to go downhill from there. Particularly with allopathic Western medicine, it's morphed into monetized sick care and then monetized sickness in all its aspects. If MAHA is to transition from a merely populist uprising and a set of immediate grievances to a new, transformed, and sustainable set of public health enterprise policies, we need to take some time to think. To think about and define acceptable limits on the role of the state in promoting, advancing, and in some cases mandating limits on infringement of individual sovereignty and autonomy. Immediate short-term interventions are absolutely necessary, and I applaud the use of both the bully pulpit as well as executive orders. But MAHA is to become more than just a populist uprising, if it's to result in sustainable, positive, long-term policy changes, it's also important to take the time required to examine, define, and develop public support for the boundaries between the proper role of a constitutional republic-based federal government, the constitutional role of individual states, which are structurally responsible for regulating the practice of medicine, not the federal, and both the sovereign rights of the individual and the global right to truly informed consent to medical interventions. I'm going to close with this. To drive home this final point, as a component of his commitment to no longer, quote, walk on eggshells, the U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, I think it was 2 days ago, recently stated that the COVID genetic, quote, vaccines were experimental products, that the vaccine mandates were illegal. These mandated experimental products were associated with severe adverse events, including myocarditis, stroke, and death. They were mandated, and the U.S. bureaucracy actively suppressed the ability of those who were either forced or willingly accepted these products to obtain informed consent. These actions were violations of the Nuremberg Accords. You cannot shirk from that anymore. It's in your face. With Pete Hegseth's statement, this is now out in the open. There must be accountability and consequences. In close, I challenge the Mises Institute to work to help establish appropriate limits on the federal bureaucracy and to insist that these limits, like the Nuremberg Accords, be enforced. If we don't have enforcement, we will see the same things recapitulated because, as was eloquently said in the prior talk, this is the nature of bureaucracy. Thanks a lot for your time. Hopefully I've met my timeline. And thank you for the opportunity to join your community briefly again.